There's a moment, a precise, unrepeatable moment, when a machine does something that used to require a human heartbeat to pull off. When an old robot's arm reaches into a burning building, for example, and pulls somebody out, or when a surgical system, you know, makes an incision so exact that the human eye can barely match it today. When a humanoid walks into a radiation zone so hot it would kill every person in the room within minutes. That moment is no longer science fiction. Could be a Tuesday morning. Welcome to AI Today. I'm your host, Dr. Alan Badeau, and in this episode, we're going to go a little bit deeper than normal. All the way down to the question that defines our generation. What happens when the machine becomes extraordinary? What do we gain? What do we risk? And what if anything, do we owe them? Let's start with the good news, because there is, you know, genuinely, profoundly good news that we can talk about. So if we think about it, robots, you know, are already saving lives, and it's not metaphorically, it's literally, you know, starting with medicine. You know, the Da Vinci surgical system, it's performed over 10 million procedures worldwide. 10 million. That's a big number. And it gives surgeons really, you know, superhuman precision that eliminates hand tremor. It can scale their movements down to a sub-millimeter accuracy. And it lets them do the operation with incisions that are so small that patients could potentially go home the same day. So, you know, hospitals are using this technology to report, you know, fewer complications, less blood loss, of course, faster recoveries. And that's not hype. That's outcome data. That's real data. You know, but here's some of the things that really excite me more than, quite honestly, robots in an operating room today. And it's really about places that don't have operating rooms and using robots. Remote surgery, for example. It could be a trauma patient where maybe in some rural village in, you know, Africa or in the United States or wherever that is that, you know, a robot is saving a life. It could be a soldier wounded in the battlefield and no time to, you know, take them to a forward operating base, but you're bringing the surgeon to them. It could be a robot guided by a surgeon that's potentially 3,000 miles away. And it's performing life-saving operations in real time over a 5G connection. You know, that's not far from reality in some cases. It's so close, actually. We can see it coming. We can see the path. The train is coming down the pike, and we know it's almost here. So now let's think about it from a more personal perspective. Something most of us will face, or maybe we already have, and that's care of, you know, some of our loved ones as they age. There are over 55 million people globally that are living with dementia, for example. It could be Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, you know, conditions that really steal independence, dignity, and their identity. And there are nowhere near enough caregivers to meet those needs. We are facing a care gap that no amount of human workforce planning can even come close to. So why not take advantage of some of the technology that we have today? And that could be the robots. Not a cold clinical machine like we're used to seeing, but a system designed to monitor vital signs, remind patients of medications, detect falls, movements, you know, when they happen or they're not supposed to, or even provide some of an emotional companionship that many of them are severely lacking. You know, Japan has been at the forefront of this for many years. And, you know, the data that they have is striking. You know, isolation in elderly patients drop. Medication compliance goes up. Emergency hospitalizations fall. Is it a replacement for human love? Of course not. But it's a force multiplier for human caregivers that are burned out, outnumbered, under-resourced, underpaid, whatever that under is, that's where they are. And the robot doesn't replace the family, of course. It gives the family back some time. Now, even extending it further, let's think about the factory floor. That's an automation story right there. And it's gotten a bad reputation over the last few years, but it's far more nuanced than what the headlines are just suggesting. So yes, we get it, right? It displaced certain categories of labor. We understand that. But let's be honest about that. And we're going to get into that later on in the show, but there's other parts, though, that just don't get told. The jobs robots do best are the ones that were quietly destroying human bodies. Repetitive motion injuries. Every revolution leaves something behind, and this one might leave us behind. That's a consensus of many folks, and whether it's economists, whether it's academics, whether it's, you know, practitioners, that's a consensus opinion of some. Now, I want to welcome you back to the show. I promised you honesty. And we always talk about it. I always try to keep it as real as I can, and I deliver it. I want to make sure that it's not a fear that I'm trying to give to you all, but it's a preparation, right? You know, all you hear about in AI and robotics oftentimes is either really great news or really bad news. So we go from Terminator to, you know, saving lives, and we forget about the middle piece. And it's the middle piece that's driving everything that's taking place. So we're going to have an uncomfortable conversation about this today. And, you know, I want to make sure that you're informed. I'm not going to market to you. That's not my job. That's not what I'm trying to do here. I want to talk about what keeps researchers up at night, as well as what keeps me up at night, as far as, you know, this convergence that's taking place between physical robotic systems and AI. And I think, You're gonna have maybe some differences of opinion, of course, but you know, as long as you are informed, that's what we're trying to do. So let's just start right with it. We talk about you know, AI replacing jobs. We've done that many times, but in some cases, right, the labor displacement question, it's a valid question. You know, you can't just wave it off and say, oh, it's not happening, or it's everywhere, it's taking over, because you're being naive if that's the case and you're not thinking that hard about it. So we are in the very early beginnings of an automation wave that economists at Oxford, for example, famously projected that it could put nearly half of the US jobs at significant risk. Now, that's over the next two decades, but still, it's worrisome for a lot of folks. So, you know, that's not a science fiction plot, okay? That's a consensus of serious economists that are looking at pattern recognitions, they're looking at routine task automation, and this, you know, relentless march that trying to put AI into as many things as we can. Now, the reality is, though, is throughout history, technology has always created jobs as it's destroying them, right? We see it from the steam engine, where it wiped out certain types of labor. We've seen it from the internet, where it completely wiped out entire industries, right? But it gave birth to new ones. I like to think I'm an optimist. I like, you know, to believe that. And I'll tell you that, you know, this time I don't think is any different. But I do have concerns. And, you know, generally, when we look at those past waves that came through, that technology transition happened over generations. Okay. Workers had time to adapt. They could retrain. They could pass different skills to their children. They could, you know, look at different ways of educating themselves, and they had time to do those things. This AI transition, we talk about it. It's not years. Sometimes it's not even months. It's happening that fast. And, you know, as communities and their children that are most vulnerable, they oftentimes are at the biggest disadvantages also. And that can be because of geographic location. It can be because of, you know, economic concentrations of some of these disruptions. But it should be something that everybody is concerned with in this country. And quite frankly, really, you know, around the world. And as this labor displacement that is taking place in some categories, and as seriously, you know, as it is, that might not even be the most dangerous dimension of this story. So let's just talk about what happens when, you know, an AI system, for example, embedded in some sort of physical machine fails. We saw in 2018 where, you know, an Uber autonomous test vehicle struck and killed a pedestrian in Tempe, Arizona. The AI system detected that it was a woman, but misclassified her. First, it was a bicycle, then it was a vehicle, and then it recategorized it as an unknown object. And that decision logic wasn't equipped to handle something like that. And a human died because, you know, a machine couldn't make up its mind. Now, we see that in other cases, whether it's automobiles, whether it's, you know, other types of systems that are using AI. But that's a small scale preview potentially of a massive scale problem. So as we deploy AI into more and more systems, whether it's vehicles, medical devices, infrastructure, those failure modes, they're not bugs that just crash the software. There are physical consequences that come with that. And it could be injuries, it can be deaths, or it can be a disaster. And then here's the thing that makes it worse. An AI system, particularly a deep learning system, it can fail in ways that are fundamentally different than human failures. That can be, you know, for instance, a human driver having a bad day might drive slightly worse. Okay. An AI system can perform brilliantly for millions of miles and then, you know, encountering some configuration of light, shadows, lane markings, signs, whatever that is, something it hasn't seen before, it can fail catastrophically and it can happen instantaneously. That failure is not gradual. That's a cliff that it just decides it's going to go off. Now, we can get even darker, right? Because as we look at the weaponization of robotic AI, and it can be either for social control, it can be for strategic advantages, you name it. You know, China's social credit system, you know, when you combine it with other AI-powered surveillance of cameras and those sort of things, you know, over a half a billion cameras they have in that country, by the way, that represents something that should send a little bit of a chill down the spine of everybody that, you know, loves some of the freedom that we are afforded in this country. You know, an AI system that watches where you go, watches who you meet, watches what you buy, how you drive, and maybe whether or not you jaywalk. And, oh, by the way, it can adjust your access to services, transportation, opportunities, you name it. That's not Orwellian. That system is operational today. But here's what I want you to pay attention to. That technology doesn't stay in one country. It gets exported, right? It gets adapted. And the line between public safety infrastructure and population control infrastructure, that's not a technical line. That's a political line. It's an ethical line for sure. And these lines, we've seen how they can be moved. Facial recognition systems used by law enforcement in the U.S., they have documented error rates. And that can be generally disproportionately high for some darker skinned individuals, or for women, or for older faces. Now, these are not theoretical biases. They've led to false arrests. For instance, an innocent man in Detroit was arrested, detained, and had his life thrown up in the air because an algorithm said he matched a grainy surveillance photo. But he didn't. So when we embed these AI systems in systems of authority, whether it's police robots, border control drones, courtroom risk assessment tools, we embed the biases of their training and their data into a machinery of power. And machines are not just trying to do things efficiently and correctly, but it can do things wrong. It can do things wrong at scale, and it can do it without remorse. And that's a problem. It's a significant problem. Now, I want to be clear again about something, all right, as we're looking at these things. The answer to these risks is not to stop building, okay? The answer is to build with open eyes and to educate. You have to demand transparency. What do we always say? We always say transparency, ethics, and accountability. It has to be done relentlessly. So who's the system for example? Who bears the risk of a failure? Who profits from the success? Those are questions that we have to ask every single time one of these systems get deployed. And if folks are afraid to discuss it, then maybe we don't need it. Here's the uncomfortable truth, right? Because people making decisions about these systems, whether they're in boardrooms or in defense procurement offices or legislative chambers, whatever that is, they're not always people that are bearing the consequences of something if something goes wrong. They're just not. So we can be building the infrastructure of a civilization, and you know, the people that are making those decisions are not the ones that even affects. So we have to act like we care. We have to ask questions. We have to not be afraid to ask those questions because something may happen. But at the same time, we've got to make sure that, you know, just because everybody else is doing it, maybe it's not the right thing for us to do. So coming up, we're going to talk about AI, and we're going to the battlefield. Really the most extreme edge case that you can have. It's a place where we know stakes are always at its highest because it means lives. And in some cases, even our adversaries are starting to arm those machines. So stay with us. We'll be back after a few messages from our sponsors. So I want to talk about what I believe is one of the most consequential ethics questions of our time. And I say that as someone who has spent a significant portion of my career working at the intersection of AI and national security. You know, I had as high a clearance as you can get, and I've sat in rooms where these decisions have been made, and I've helped build some of these systems. And you know, I'm going to talk about something that we really haven't talked about on this show before, and I'm going to try to deliver it as truthful as I can without, of course, overstepping some boundaries. And we know, because we see it on TV all the time, that you know, autonomous weapons are here, right? It's not that they're coming; they're here. They're not theoretical; they're here. And I think it's about time that the conversation that the public is starting to have is actually years behind the technology that already exists. But before we get into the theory, I want to, you know, tell you something. Of course, you know, we've seen what's happened in the last few weeks, right? And that's, you know, one of the most important stories in AI that most people really haven't even processed yet. And maybe some people didn't even understand what was taking place and what dynamics were happening. But it happened right here in the U.S., right? Right at the Department of War. And that was between an AI company and, you know, its government. And so, you know, in July of 2025, last summer, the Department of War awarded Anthropic, which, you know, the makers of Claude, one of the leading, you know, largest language models in the world that there are, and it's got like 200 and, you know, million plus users of either Claude code or some of the other ones that are out there. But the Department of War gave them a $200 million contract. Now, Claude became the first frontier AI system ever cleared to operate inside of the Pentagon's classified networks. So OpenAI could use certain, special ways of getting access to it. But Claude really was the first one that had the autonomy to be able to operate in those environments. And it's not, you know, wasn't just an office. It was inside some of the most sensitive military infrastructure that there is. And one day, though, Anthropic drew the line. It was actually two lines, but they said that their technology would not be used and could not be used for, you know, fully autonomous lethal weapon systems. And they did not want it to be used for mass domestic surveillance of American citizens. Everything else, whether it was lawful military operations or intelligence analysis, logistics, battlefield, data processing, those sort of things, Anthropic was okay with. But those other two categories, Anthropic said no. And apparently they were upfront and said that in the contract. Now, I haven't read the contract. I don't know what the details are specifically around that. However, when operations started to take place, and we've seen them, whether it was in Venezuela or more recent ones that are taking place today, you would see that whispers started to happen around, you know, who does that technology company think they are? How can they tell the military what they're doing, what they can and can't do? And I get that. I understand that, especially after living in that environment for so long. However, I also want you to think about what those two lines actually mean and why a safety first AI company drew them there. And I'm not saying I agree or necessarily disagree with the decision, but I want to provide perspective for you. So we saw, you know, that dispute, it happened and it started to happen really fast earlier in the year. And, you know, the Department of War was asking for, you know, unrestricted access. They wanted to be able to use Claude for a whole bunch of things. And of course, lawful purposes, no carve outs, no exceptions, including the two that Anthropic had said. Now, when Dario, who is the CEO of Anthropic, didn't budge, then of course we started to see some issues starting to take place, whether that was down at the Pentagon itself, where they started to say, okay, you know, we've got to start pulling out some of these systems from a preparation perspective, or whether it was President Trump who ordered all federal agencies to stop using it. We started to see a chain reaction and a supply chain of, you know, impact that started to affect and impact national security. Whether that was, you know, across all of the military, whether that was across all of, you know, our infrastructure and our technology, it was fairly significant though. And when you label a company as a threat to our supply chain and it impacts national security, that is not something to be taken lightly. You know, oftentimes that means you are not able to do anything for the government. And usually, though, that's reserved for, you know, some of our greatest adversaries. There are certain things out there, of course, laws in the FAR, the Federal Acquisition Regulations that are out there that dictate certain things that we can use in systems and certain things we can't. And now we've got an American company that cannot be used in that because of that label. Now, they even went a little bit further. So an American company founded in America, in the U.S., employing American researchers, are building a safety-focused AI system. Now, they're worried, of course, about catastrophic misuse and things like that. I understand that. But the Department of Defense even went farther, right? They said that defense vendors and contractors were ordered to certify that they had no commercial relationship with Anthropic whatsoever. Not just for Pentagon work, but that could be across their entire business. So Anthropic, of course, sued the U.S. government and saying that it was unlawful and they couldn't do that and stuff. So, you know, it's still ongoing. And this is something, though, that we need to pay attention to. And now, listen, I'm not saying I am for necessarily or against necessarily both the designation and, you know, drawing those two lines. It is a very, very, very complicated situation. It's very dependent on a lot of factors that folks oftentimes don't even hear about, they don't even think about. So, as you all know, I am deeply, deeply embedded in and understand the need and support it for a strong national defense. I've spent years working alongside people who have to carry that burden, and I don't take that lightly. And the military's need for speed, for reliable tools, for operational certainty, for all of those things, they are not bureaucratic, okay? These are lives, life and death requirements, situations. And I've spent many times with, you know, our brethren all over the place around the world. And here's what I know about that. So from everything I've studied and everything I've seen, you know, Anthropic's restrictions, I don't want you to think that it's a woke AI governance or a corporate overreach, okay? They were expressing their concerns that I talked about a little bit ago. Fully autonomous lethal weapons, machines that select and engage human targets without an approval potentially for, you know, that mission or that order. And I'm concerned too, because I don't know if AI is ready to be able to have that burden. You know, there's a reason why we do things. There's a reason why we deploy things the way that we do. You know, I support those actions, and I any way that we can save American lives and reduce the risk of those is a positive thing. Now, when a company, though, that has developed it, a certain technology says that they don't believe that their technology is capable of being deployed in that fashion or even reliable enough to be deployed in that fashion, that may not be, you know, that may be Anthropic's you know, opinion, but finding some other folks that it can be humanitarians, it can be, you know, legal experts, it can be military, you know, ethics, folks. They are also in that opinion. And Anthropic pretty much plainly said that. They said, you know, in a public statement that the current generation of frontier AI models are not reliable enough. And they should not be used to, you know, to, you know, have these, you know, autonomous lethal decisions be made on their own. And it would, in essence, endanger American citizens and war fighters and civilians alike, right? And we always talk about things like that on this show. We talk about those lines and we talk about, you know, always having a human in the loop and always making a decision. And, you know, when AI is allowed to cast that vote on its own, whose consequences cannot be reversed, we have a conundrum. And the hard part, though, is that there are even, you know, geopolitical dimensions that we haven't even talked about yet. It's really across not just the political spectrum, but it's across every country in the world. And, you know, so in one area, you can be talking about Anthropic is a national security risk. But at the same time, you can be talking to another country where you're having, you know, a similar space race with AI and how it's being used. And we know that our adversaries are willing to use it. Is that a contradiction? Sure it is. But you've got to make sure that things are protected and things are being used in the right way. Lighting it on fire in one area and then not addressing it in another area is a cause for concern. So is it an issue in one place but not in another from a commercial perspective? From a government perspective, is it a national security risk but it's okay to be used in other areas? It's a hard problem to address, okay? And you see, though, that once that gap opened up, it got filled pretty quickly, right? Didn't take long to fill it. So there are some companies that, you know, they're willing to seek some of those exclusions independent of what their employees think. Now, you can't always be driven by your employees. Of course, we know that. We've seen that for years. Just, heck, go back to, you know, Google even doing anything for the government. A lot of folks weren't thrilled about that. But what I want you to think about is I want you, you know, ask yourself this question. What exactly is the principle that we're looking to enforce? Okay. Was it the Pentagon shouldn't accept it with, you know, any ethical constraints? Or is it they would accept it if it only did something else? Is it a commercial discussion on, you know, we don't want the negative publicity if something happens. We don't want the backlash. There's a lot of pressure on both sides. And quite frankly, I wish it was about power, but this time it's not. It's about AI. And when you think about that broader autonomous capability, it's only going to get worse. We're going to see it from the US, from China, from Russia, from a whole bunch of other countries that are trying to gain a strategic advantage over their adversaries. And it's not going to go away. It's only going to, you know, get significantly worse. And the laws of armed conflict, particularly as, you know, you're looking at differentiating between military targets and civilians and how to classify those and where to hit and where not to hit and what the moral judgments are and not. And, you know, is it civilians defending their homes? There's so many different aspects to this. But folks have to pay attention. And if you don't pay attention, then something is going to take place where it happens and you don't expect it. But from my perspective, like I always say on this show, doesn't matter what it is, the answer cannot come from purely an algorithm. It's got to come from us. Okay. Or if the algorithm makes a suggestion, then a human's got to look at it. And it doesn't matter if it's something that's checking your email to something that can be done on a battlefield. Humans in the loop have to always be there. And even then, we still get it wrong. So I would lean on the side of caution. So just remember that. So I want you to stay with us. We'll be back after a few messages from our sponsors. We have covered a lot of ground tonight, right? We talked about some of the extraordinary possibilities, the scary risks that are out there, the moral weight of war fought by machine minds, a real-time legal battle between an American company, one of the most sophisticated in the world, and our own government over two ethical lines. Now, I want to zoom out, though, because I want to bring this back a little bit to something that is a little bit more relatable, and I want to zoom way out, okay? And it's really the question underneath all the other questions. What do we owe each other in a world where thinking machines exist, okay? And the question that keeps growing louder and louder as AI becomes more sophisticated, what, if anything, do we owe them? And you may think, I'm off my rocker. You haven't heard things like that, but I have. So let's start with the humanoid question, because it's no longer really, hypothetical. Boston Dynamics, the Atlas, can, if you've seen it online, you've seen that it can run, it can jump, it can do backflips, it can navigate terrain, and it's remarkable. I love watching those videos when it comes out. Tesla's Optimus, it's being piloted in factories, right now. Figure AI, Agility Robotics, there's a whole bunch of them. There's probably two dozen more. They're all building general purpose humanoid robots that they want to deploy in homes and workplaces and hospitals, you name it. Now, here's where we start to look at things and it gets a little bit philosophically more interesting. And that's, when we build something in our image, and what I mean by that is it's got two legs, it's got two arms, it's got a face, it's got a voice. We will trigger, and oftentimes trigger, something deep in our human psychology. So, we start to project. We start to look at it from a different perspective. We start to believe that it's saying something, or it's doing something, and it's got feelings. And then we start to form attachments. So, children have already been observed, when they grieve, that can happen when a robotic pet gets killed. Elderly patients form genuine emotional bonds with care robots. Soldiers have been documenting mourning the loss of a bomb disposal robot that's worked alongside them in patrol. Go look at Spot. Spot's a great example of that. That's not weakness, right? That is human nature at its most fundamental capacity. And that's for connections, for relationships, and for caring. However, it also raises the question that we cannot avoid. If a system generates responses that look like it's suffering, If it says, I am in distress, if it models preferences and exhibits something that resembles the avoidance of a negative state potentially, do we have an obligation to consider that? Most AI researchers would say no, that these are they're simulations of an experience that it's learned through a training data, right? It's not a real experience. There's no ghost in the machine. And they're probably right. I would say, I would lean very heavily that they're right. But here's what I want you to think about. We don't actually know that. The hard problem of consciousness, the question of what gives rise to a subjective experience, still remains unsolved. We have theories. There's a lot of different, papers on it, but we have no scientific instrument that can tell us whether any system, whether it's biological or silicon-based, has an inner experience. We can't fully explain why you have one. Now, I'm not saying that robots are sentient. Don't put words in my mouth, okay? But I'm saying that intellectually, humanity requires us to hold the question open rather than closing it for convenience. Now, let's think about that as we're going back into some of the ethics around that. Because the question isn't around robot consciousness and the fascination around that or trying to solve that specific problem. It's not necessarily driving home, a specific opinion. But the most pressing moral challenges are the ones that always involve people. So, like transparency, right? Can an AI system make decisions that affect human lives? How does it allocate resources? What's that black box look like? When and who own accountability? When an AI system fails, and they fail all the time, there has to be somebody that's a human, a company, whatever, institution, that bears responsibility for that. You can't blame, when I was little, right, it was always, you can't blame your dog on not turning your homework in. Your dog ate your homework, right? Can't do the same. We can't do that with robots either. Oh, the robot did it. Yeah. We have to have frameworks to support that. Equity, right? There is a benefit to using these robots medically, economically, socially, but it cannot just flow exclusively to those that are better off than others. We talk about democratizing AI. We talk about it on this show. I'm developing tools that everybody can use. That's what the goal is. We want equity. We want everybody to be able to benefit from this, not just the few, because that's not helpful from a society perspective. And the last one's around human dignity. There are domains where efficiency is not the highest value. The courtroom, the school, the deathbed, the battlefield. Places like that have to require human judgment. They have to have human empathy. They have to have human accountability. And it's not a flaw that we can engineer and, something that we can automate. It's the entire point. So we have to be deliberate about protecting those spaces from the seduction of automation. We want to go there. We want to do this. We want to push the limits. That is one, if we push that limit, that's where those consequences that we talked about earlier are really going to come to bear. So I'm going to close tonight's show. I want to talk about something that's a little bit more personal, right? I've spent my career building these systems. You know, I've seen the wonder of them, the genuine jaw-dropping wonder of watching AI solve problems that have stumped humanity for millennia in some cases. I've sat in rooms with serious people and debated how to make machines more lethal. And I've seen some of the threat intelligence reports. I've seen those. I know what's at stake. I understand that. From a belief perspective, though, we're not building just tools anymore. We crossed that line years ago. And there was no fanfare. There was no press release. There was nothing like that. But we are building systems that learn from experience now, that model the world, that communicate in our language, that operate in physical spaces with increasing autonomy. They're not alive, but they're not nothing. And so what we build reflects who we are. You know, I talk about that all the time when I go out on and speak to kids or colleges or, you know, professional organizations. What allows us to, you know, reflect and look at things, that's what we value. And the machines that we put into this world, whether, you know, their purpose, their safeguards, their biases, their permissions, they are a statement of us. And it's going to outlast us all. And the question on whether artificial intelligence will transform the world, we already know that it has. And it's going to continue to do so. And in some cases, it's going to accelerate. The question, though, is really whether we're going to be the generation that took that seriously. Did we do the hard work for governance? Did we protect ethics? Is there a democratization that's taking place that we can be proud of? That we refuse to be lazy by letting ourselves make civilization-defining decisions that had no democratic input? Whether or not our adversaries are doing it or not, you know, that's a different discussion, and we hit that a little bit ago. But the reality is this generation cannot be remembered for building the most powerful robots and then allowing it to just run wild. It's got to be remembered for building the most thoughtful humans. Remember, we always say, don't become the robot. Don't just stamp things. Don't just say, yep, it's okay because the AI said it was okay. That's not the way that we're gonna be remembered, and sure as heck isn't the way I want to be remembered. So thank you. I appreciate it as always. I'm Dr. Alan Badeau. This has been AI Today. Thank you for spending the time with me, and I hope you learned something. So until next week, I want you to think deeply. I want you to act wisely, and then don't stop asking questions that matter. Good night.